Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for November 16, 2006. This is Doug Henwin. We're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got the usual two interviews lined up for tonight. In a few minutes, we'll speak with Algernon Austin, who is a sociologist and a founder of the Thora Institute, which is researching social issues affecting black Americans. And we'll speak with him mainly about his book, Getting It Wrong, How Black Public Intellectuals Are Failing Black America. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll listen to an interview recorded earlier today with Jim Gerstein, who is the executive director of the Democracy Corps. And they're very closely tied with the Stan Greenberg polling operation. They've been doing extensive polling and focus grouping around the election, and we'll get their outlook on what it all meant, why the election turned out the way it did, what's going on with the public mood, et cetera, et cetera. Before we get to that, some economic headlines. Earlier today, the Labor Department reporting first-time claims for unemployment insurance. Falling by 2,000, although last week's total was revised upward. And so the four-week moving average is holding pretty steady in the low 300,000s, which is, as I've been saying for many, many months now, a good but not a great number. And 2.4 million people continuing to draw unemployment insurance. And that's somewhat less than half the actual unemployed because of eligibility restrictions and such have been tightened. Eligibility has been tightened over the years. A much larger portion of the unemployed were covered by unemployment insurance benefits 20, 30 years ago, but those have become less available, as have many things, and are very stingy, almost non-existent welfare state. A lot of excitement among economic pundits that the housing bubble, which burst, well, the worst may be behind us, or so they're saying. Some evidence for that is the second monthly rise in the National Association of Home Builders Market Index. They poll their member builders for their perceptions and feelings, and that took a very, very steep dive from the beginning of the year through September. It's now up two consecutive months, although it hasn't really made up much of its loss. And also Mortgage Bankers Association's index of applications for new mortgages also picking up as mortgage rates decline slightly. So it may take a long time for this housing thing to work through. The English example, Britain had a major housing bubble. Just very similar to ours, a couple of year or two ahead of our schedule, actually. And the Bank of England began raising interest rates in 2003, 2004, and then paused in 2005. The housing market took a dive, but then regained a lot of life in 2005. And then the Bank of England raising interest rates again, then knocking the housing market for a fall as well. So it could be that any pause by the Federal Reserve, which we've been seeing now for several months in increasing interest rates, will bring back the animal spirits in the housing market. So we'll see. But it does appear to be exerting a drag on retail sales. The Commerce Department reporting earlier in the week that retail sales in the month of October down 0.2%, following a sharply downwardly revised September number down 0.8%, leaving out autos. Down 0.4% in October and 1.2% in September. So it does seem that the loss of air in the housing bubble has either made less funds available for people to borrow or less exuberance for them to get optimistic about buying stuff. But in any case, it does appear that housing decline weighing on consumption to some degree. Although attitudes skyrocketing, according to the ABC Washington Post Consumer Comfort Index, that continuing a rise that began in early September, remarkable, after a deep slide, now it's the highest it's been since April 2002. It's hard to see what in the real economy is encouraging this, perhaps to lower gas prices, maybe the fact that the election is behind us. There was an enormous partisan gap between the way Democrats and Republicans have been seeing the economy. Democrats much, much gloomier than Republicans, even if you consider the fact that Republicans are richer than Democrats. It's still a very wide partisan gap. Maybe that's narrowing. Maybe the Democrats are getting a more upbeat view. We shall see in the coming weeks. And then the Federal Open Market Committee, the policy-setting arm of the Federal Reserve, releasing its minutes earlier in the week, and that shows some worry about inflation among the policymakers. And although they think the economy is slowing down, and as a result of it, the inflationary pressures will reduce, they are remaining vigilant, whatever that means exactly. And let's see. This morning, it was reported that consumer prices in the month of October falling 0.5%, and up just 1.3% on the year. That mainly the result of a very sharp drop in energy prices. Leaving out food and energy, we have just a tenth of a point gain, or 2.8% year on year. Still higher than the Federal Reserve is said to want. They thought to want between 1% and 2%, but it may be going. It's going in the right direction, so they may hold off on further tightening. And then, finally, Milton Friedman, one of the prime intellectual influences on the right-wing turn in politics over the last 30 years, died earlier today at the age of 94. Although you're not supposed to speak ill of the dead, at least for a few weeks, for him I'll make an exception. As an economist, Friedman's major contributions, if you can call them that, don't really hold up to empirical scrutiny. One of his more famous contributions, the notion that people consume based on their long-term expectations for income rather than the basis of short-term fluctuation, is at best unproved. And his most famous contribution, the doctrine that changes in the supply of money, which he assumed to be directly under the control of central banks like the Federal Reserve, those changes in the money supply lead changes in the rate of inflation, has been proved almost completely worthless. Central banks are only in partial control of the money supply. Private demand for credit is also a major influence, which banks tend to accommodate. And more importantly, it's nearly impossible to find any connection between movements in the money supply, which, by the way, consists mainly of currency, checking accounts, and short-term bank deposits, and the inflation rate. Friedman advised Margaret Thatcher's government in the late 1970s that it could end high British inflation by cutting back on the money supply without any consequences for the real world, real incomes. In fact, the monetary crackdown led to a deep recession and millions of job losses. So much for his economic contributions. His political influence was unfailingly malignant. He was at the forefront of reaction since he first came on the scene in the 1950s, both within his profession and in the broader society. Within the profession, he sought to undermine the dominance of John Maynard Keynes, who, though no revolutionary, was certainly a humanizing influence on economics and economic policy, and those associated welfare state policies that are considered Keynesian or social democratic. And in the broader world, Friedman ceaselessly promoted bare-knuckles capitalism as the only proper way to run a society. It's ugly, polarizing, and destructive. And despite all his libertarian democratic talk, his approval of the Pinochet regime in Chile, and his students' central role as advisors to that dictatorial, murderous government, reveal the dependence on coercion at the core of neoliberal policy. So goodbye, Milty. You lived too long, did too much damage, and thank you for finally shuffling off. And since I don't know of any songs especially addressed to you, I'll replay this 25-year-old masterpiece by a Swedish band, Chartist 77, an intense gesture of hostility to his ideological soulmate, Ronald Reagan, which I first played on the occasion of Reagan's death. Let's hear a little bit of this. And that's the first minute or so of the song Ronald Reagan by the Swedish band Chartist 77 from the early 1980s. Ronald Reagan, monkey, donkey, canker, wanker, all kinds of bad things, and Milton Friedman, too. And now we're joined on the line by Algernon Austin, who is a sociologist and founder of the Thori Institute, an institute devoted to doing social research on issues reflecting affecting black Americans. Welcome to Behind the News, Algernon.
My pleasure to be here.
So, tell us first about the Thori Institute. What's your mission?
The Thori Institute is a research company that I've formed, and it's looking at advocating for progressive public policies for blacks. It's also particularly concerned with countering false negative stereotypes about blacks that are circulating widely today.
All right, and you have a little book devoted to that very topic, Getting It Wrong, How Black Public Intellectuals Are Failing Black America. Who are these public intellectuals you've got in your sights?
Unfortunately, there are far too many. Many of the leading black public intellectuals really doing rather poor data analysis. People debate whether to put Bill Cosby in that category of a black public intellectual, but he certainly has been.
But he has a PhD, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. He certainly has been quite prominent in terms of spreading false negative stereotypes about blacks. John McWhorter of the Manhattan Institute. And unfortunately, the issue that I'm writing about or that I talk about, I say that it's really from liberal to conservative. So Juan Williams, Henry Louis Gates, and many others, unfortunately, have not looked very carefully at the data and have contributed to this circulation of false information about blacks.
Yeah, I see Juan Williams on the Fox Network pretty often, on the O'Reilly show even. I wonder how the guy looks himself in the mirror sometimes.
Yeah, I was surprised when I found out that he was in the Fox Network, but, you know, that's his story.
Well, let's talk. You mentioned Bill Cosby, so he's a good place to start. I'm not sure whether he's an intellectual, but he's certainly a very prominent figure, and I guess since he does have a PhD, he qualifies in some sense. But he got famous a couple of years ago for saying some very harsh things about what some people call the black underclass.
Right.
Let's talk about that word underclass in the first
place. Right.
Where did that come from in the first place?
Well, it came from, it has a too long of a history, but it was really popularized during the 1980s. There were several reports about this new, what was supposedly a new phenomenon, a crisis of an underclass. And one of the problems with this class, quote-unquote class concept, is how much it throws pretty much everything in to this concept, everything in but the kitchen sink. So there's a lot of focus on out-of-wedlock births, school performance, everything. And what happens, in fact, and a legacy today, is that people actually stop looking at poverty statistics
underclass,
at everything else.
This underclass idea is more of a moral concept than an economic one.
Certainly, yes. It's a moral concept, and it's very much, if you, the people that I cite in my book today, Cynthia Tucker, who's an editorial writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and Henry Louis Gates, really use it as a culture of poverty concept. So it's a concept that argues that people are poor because they're lazy, irresponsible, et cetera. If you're poor, it's your own fault, and if you just behave differently, you will be wealthy, or not poor at least.
Now, how much of the use by successful people like Gates of a term like underclass it comes from their own anxiety about being tarred by the association with these disreputable folks?
You know, that is a really good question, and it's something. I mean, there are several speculations. I don't know for sure, but one issue that people raise. I mean, one about trying to understand why there's so much middle class support and why there's so much sort of anger behind the discussions right now is that people are trying to distance themselves from poor blacks. There is a sense that this is tapping into sort of class conflict among blacks. So people certainly do raise that issue.
But it's also a way of flattering themselves that there was something about them, their
right.
own character that brought them such success that other people are not capable of.
Exactly, yes.
So what are the facts, though? Let's say you mentioned all these indicators of social distress or decay.
Right.
Are they as bad as they're said to be?
No, and actually the big irony about this is that the 1990s was a very good decade for blacks on a number of measures, not the least of which was the measure of poverty. And black poverty actually declined by about a third over the 1990s. It was the biggest decline that we've seen in the last three decades. And the lowest black poverty rate on record with the Census Bureau was 2000. So a few years after, we have this dramatic decline in black poverty. The Brookings Institution called it stunning progress. After this stunning progress, lowest poverty rate on record, then we have several leading black public intellectuals attack the black poor. So there's a complete disconnect between the facts on the ground and the public discourse about blacks and poverty.
What was behind that decline in the poverty rate? There's certainly not much in the way of government policies that were either very
right.
poor-friendly or black-friendly.
Right. What you see, and that's the other thing with what's so frustrating about the discourse right now and why I say black public intellectuals are failing black America is because there was an important lesson in the 1990s. We had a very strong economy, expansion of the economy, more job opportunities for blacks, maybe slight increases in wages at the lower end of the spectrum, and as a result, a dramatic decline in black poverty. Again, the Brookings Institution called it stunning progress. And we'd seen that one other time in history in the post-World War II economy with a big expansion, there was again a dramatic decline in black poverty. So if we want to reduce black poverty, we have to look at, okay, simply, you know, how do we expand the job opportunities and increase the wages of blacks at the lower end of the economic spectrum?
And since we don't have much in the way of social policy, all we can hope for is a low unemployment rate being sustained over the course of
right,
years.
Right. But in terms of social policy, the other thing that's missing is that there's a considerable amount of research showing that there is still significant discrimination in the labor market. So we should at the very least be, you know, trying to get the government to enforce anti-discrimination laws as aggressively as possible.
Well, yours is very much a good news, bad news story. So there's, you know, progress, but problems remain. So
Right. And I think
what about that discrimination? How serious is it?
It is quite serious, and you can see it in many measures. I think the most powerful measure is audit studies that have been done by a sociologist at Princeton University, Deborah Pager. And what she did was she took college students, black and white college students, and actually she did the study in Milwaukee and in New York, and in New York she had black, Latino, and white college students, trained them to present themselves in the same way, fill out job applications in the same way, giving identical information, sent them out and to apply for hundreds of jobs. And then she looked at what was the response rate for these different racial groups. And consistently, both in New York and Milwaukee, which shouldn't surprise anyone who knows the history of discrimination in the U.S., whites were much likely to be offered jobs and to be called back for interviews than blacks. And again,
as I recall, we had her in the program here, and I think she said that even whites with a criminal record got more callbacks than blacks without a criminal record.
Exactly, yeah. So, so this is why it's so frustrating when you have Juan Williams and John McWhorter saying, you know, stop complaining about discrimination, you know, and downplaying the significance of that.
I'm speaking with Algernon Austin, who is a sociologist and the founder of the Thora Institute. Let's talk about educational attainment. There is a lot of stories in the papers and on the TV about persistent black inability to catch up with white folks in school. How bad or how good is the news there?
Well, the news is there is good news in that in terms of achievement scores, blacks are improving. In terms of going to college, blacks are improving. So there are many, many ways that there's progress. The problem is that whites are also progressing in all of these measures, particularly in terms of going to college. Whites are increasing their rate of going to college at a rate faster than blacks. And I think, again, we have to look at the economic issue behind that. I mean, going to college costs money. Many blacks who are the the first to go to college in their families don't may not be savvy and as informed about financial aid, may not be as willing to accumulate as much debt as whites, you know, whites who are wealthier in both in terms of income and assets, you know, can more easily take on, afford college, et cetera. So, you know, I think a big part, not the only part, but a big part of the reason why blacks are not increasing their college enrollment and graduation rates as much as whites is just the simple cost of college.
Yeah, now this is visible if you look at studies of access to college by income class. The gap between rich and poor and access to college is actually widening as college gets more expensive. So this kind of brings up that old race versus class issue. I mean, how much of this, what we're talking about, is a result of pure racial effects, and how much is class? Or are they all so mixed up that we couldn't sort this out in the radio in 5 minutes?
Yeah, it's hard to sort them out, but it's very important that I think we look at the very least, at both. You know, I think if we just talk about race, we're going to miss a lot. And if we just talk about class, we're going to miss a lot. But certainly we need to pay attention to, you know, the economics of the cost of college, like you mentioned. We definitely need to talk about both. And it's very hard to disentangle them.
And, of course, the issue of crime is never far from the surface when we're discussing race in America.
Right, right.
Or what's the truth versus the mythology of blacks and crime?
Unfortunately, there's a big analytical error that many black public intellectuals make, and they fail to distinguish between the crime rate and the incarceration rate. Now, the incarceration rate has been increasing steadily since the 1970s, because in the 1970s and 80s we declared a war on drugs and implemented tough on crime policies. So in the 1970s our incarceration rate was about average for Western industrialized nations, and right now it's number one in the world, far, far above the rest of the Western industrialized nations. So that's the incarceration rate, many people don't realize, is driven by our criminal justice policies. The crime rate...
Yeah, our crime rates are not that far... property crime rates. We do have, you know, murder rates that are out of line with the rest of the world, but the property crime rate is not out of line with the rest of the world.
Right, right. But the other thing with the crime rate is that if you're just looking at the incarceration rate, you probably miss the fact that over the 1990s, even the violent crime rate declined dramatically. I mean, the black violent crime rate over the 1990s was cut in about half. So many cities, many urban spaces were much safer in 2000 than they were in 1990 or 1980. Yet much of the discussion, people just focus on the incarceration rate and fail to realize that we really need to ask ourselves, are these criminal justice policies fair, reasonable, sensible? Especially when we see, you know, incarceration increasing and crime decreasing, we have to, you know, there should be a critical examination of the incarceration policies.
And then you have a section in the book, The Myth of Black Self-Hate, which you introduce with quotes from Bell Hooks, who says, "We black folks have been unwilling to break through our denial and to deal with the truth that crippling low self-esteem has reached epidemic proportions." And Randall Robinson says, "We now hate ourselves." What's that all about, and what's your reaction to it?
Well, that's a very long-standing idea, and the interesting thing there is it used to be that people argued that segregation produced self-hate, and now people argue that integration produces self-hate. Unfortunately, many, many social problems people see as being rooted in self-esteem, when I think often there are other issues that are the real cause. But when you look at the research, and there have been several, you know, literally, you know, hundreds of studies looking at race and self-esteem, blacks actually score equal or higher than whites in terms of global self-esteem. So to understand, you know, educational achievement or any other social issue, I think we need to stop trying to look for the answer in self-esteem and look elsewhere.
There seems to be another instance of a tendency to turn a material, economic, or social or policy problem into one of psychology or morals.
Exactly. That's precisely it. So, you know, the educational disparities, a lot of it goes back to, you know, basic social and economic status, you know, what type of schools, how educated your parents are, et cetera. But, yes, I do think that the tendency to psychologize social problems is a problem.
Yes. And you also take Tavis Smiley to task for complaining after listening to the 2004 presidential debates that they only got to the black issues in the last 15 minutes. What annoyed you about Smiley's remark?
Well, what I think is important there, I want people to realize, and I think it's very important for black Americans to realize, to take that this is their country and that they're part of it, and that what happens in the American economy, for example, in the American economy, is a black issue. And our foreign policy, you know, whether we go to war with the country, the armed forces are disproportionately black. So our military policy, our foreign policy is a black issue. You know, our educational policy is a black issue. Whether we spend money on a bridge to nowhere or spend it on developing, you know, if we spend money on bridge to nowhere, that's money that we're not spending on black, on urban communities, on economic development. So basically every issue is a black issue from my perspective.
But you know, coming after an election when Michigan rejected affirmative action, it's very hard to convince the mostly white voting public that these kinds of race and social justice issues are important. Is there a way to make that this agenda more palatable, or is it just going to be a long, hard slog?
It's going to be a long, hard slog, but, you know, I hope I'm trying to do some work with the Economic Policy Institute on this issue, and I think the hopeful part is that, you know, actually people in the military and business and some business leaders recognize that, you know, we're better off when we have sort of integrated workplaces where people have opportunity. You know, there are some folks who recognize this, and I was just looking at a study by the Gallup survey, which again repeats the point that, you know, workplaces where everyone in the workplace feels welcome function better and are more productive. So I'm hoping that line will be able, you know, that you can get a broad base behind that. Behind sort of people's desire to have a better and more productive society. Another related issue, there have been surveys looking at interest in science education, and black students express a great deal of interest in getting more science education. As a matter of fact, white students generally don't say they want more science education, probably because they're getting better science education than blacks are.
Yeah, they just rather play video games, I think. I'm afraid we're actually out of time, so I have to bring it to a close. The Thor Institute, if people want to find out more about your work, how can they do that?
www.thora, that's T-H-O-R-A, institute.com. And the book, Getting It Wrong, How Black Public Intellectuals Are Failing Black America, is available from barnesandnoble.com and amazon.com.
All right, thanks for joining us. I've been speaking with Algernon Austin, who is the founder of the Thoria Institute and author of that book, Getting It Wrong, which you can get from Amazon or Barnes & Noble online. Unfortunately, not in any brick-and-mortar stores yet. Let's take a break, and we'll be back to listen to Jim Gerstein.
Hi, this is Lloyd Price, and you're tuned to WBAI New York. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
And this is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and let's take a musical break and come back to listen to Jim Gerstein.
We are sick and tired of being promised this and that. We work all day, we sweat and we save to keep the wealthy fat. Things in our heads with promises and bamboos and us with facts. Then they block false sincerity, then they laugh behind our backs. Money and corruption are ruining the land. Crooked politicians betray the working man. Pockets in their bosses and treat us like sheep. We're tired of hearing promises in all the magazines. Money and corruption ruin in the land. Crooked politicians betray the working man. Pockets in their bosses and treat us like sheep. We're tired of hearing promises in all the magazines.
Robinson.
And that bit from the Kinks, old song, Money and Corruption, a perfect setup for a conversation about the recent election. And this is Jim Gerstein, who is the executive director of the Democracy Corps, a group that was founded in the late 90s by a bunch of Clinton slash semi-progressive Democrats, Stan Greenberg, and some folks like that. But I thought they do a lot of good polling and analysis, and even though I'm not in love with their policy point of view, I thought it was worth listening to what their view of the recent election was. So Jim Gerstein of the Democracy Corps, interview recorded earlier today.
First of all, what's your general explanation of last Tuesday's election results?
I think that things have been going bad for President Bush, basically from the beginning of his second term, and it was getting worse leading into last summer. And then when Katrina happened, it shattered any standing that he had. People were no longer going to give him the benefit of the doubt. It really revealed a lot about the way they govern. And it, from that point on, what happened is there was a new dynamic in the electorate, and that dynamic held stable through the election. This election was well defined, and the election was very stable for over a year. And what drove it, and that could be marked by three main dynamics. The first being Iraq, of course, and Iraq's gotten a lot of coverage in all the post-election discussions. And obviously, that is what drove the negative mood in the country. People were very upset, were and continue to be very upset about the direction the country is taking in Iraq, but they had for a long time been divided over what to do on it. As the election got closer and closer, and it was clear that Bush didn't represent a change of course and was going to continue the same path, the country moved further away from the president and the Republican Congress that was seen as just doing whatever he wanted on Iraq. Democrats at this point became credible as doing something different, as offering a different course in Iraq. And that was the number one driving dynamic in the election. Second dynamic that's been a little bit underreported has been the attitude towards Congress itself, which had abysmal approval ratings. And people, regardless of where we would go in the country, we did tons of focus groups talking to voters for the last 3 months. Regardless where you went, what the demographic was, people had a universal disgust for the Republican Congress. They viewed it as very self-interested. These were politicians who were putting partisan interests ahead of the public. They were putting personal interests ahead of the public. And the most visible symbol of this, or the most which we saw used very effectively in numerous television advertising across the country, was the pay raise that Congress gave itself. You go back and look at some of the ads that were running in these close districts. We had there were Democrats running ads that said Congressman so-and-so voted for a pay raise for himself, but at the same time refused to give a pay raise to the troops. It was very effective, tapped in very effectively to what people hated about Congress, and more importantly, linked what they hated about Congress to the individual member who they had known for, because he was an incumbent, he or she were an incumbent, this made the linkage between what they didn't like about Congress to something that was credible and believable about the, this member that they were ready to give the benefit of the doubt. The other thing to note with the disgust towards Congress is that it really was about this Republican Congress. Not one single Democrat lost in the entire, you know, across the country. So this was a big statement about Congress and the Republican Congress in particular. The third dynamic has changed. Obviously, Iraq drove the mood in the country, but it wasn't, the election wasn't just about Iraq. There was a big negative mood in the country with over 60% saying the country was going in the wrong direction. They wanted a change of course. Things like the difficulty in keeping up with the cost of living and people's incomes not rising the same way that healthcare costs and gas prices were rising. So people just wanted a change of leadership in Washington. They wanted a change in direction for the country.
Now, let's step back to 94. That was, of course, the previous big shift in Congress. That was a heavily ideological shift. The Republicans had their contract with America, which was pure right-wing religion. This shift seems much less ideological. Is there anything happening beneath the surface?
Well, something important is happening beneath the surface. They pursued a very base-oriented strategy in this election. The consequence of that is independents moved dramatically towards Democrats. So the situation here where independents voted 58-38 for Democratic candidates, that changes the entire battlefield. It made Democrats competitive in over 50 congressional districts. The Democrats won in a lot of red states. It puts a whole new look on the 2008 political landscape, both for Congress and for the presidency. So the ideological component to this was really a rejection of the Bush very conservative Republican agenda. It was a total rejection of that, and it moved important swing blocks towards the Democrats.
And is there any programmatic content to it, any kind of agenda that the electorate is expecting, or they just wanted something different and they weren't precisely sure what?
I think the public is going to be watching what the Democrats do very, very carefully. If you go back to the second dynamic I mentioned, which was the disgust towards Congress, Democrats are going to need to take some steps and deliver on some promises that show that they are in touch with the public. Things like raising the minimum wage, negotiating, allowing the government to negotiate drug prices for Medicare, things that show that this is a Congress that is not going to is going to do things differently, not going to be taking its orders from corporate lobbyists, and things like that were very important to voters in the election, and Democrats will be measured by how much they deliver on those things.
There's been a lot of talk about how some of the newly elected Democrats are fairly conservative, blue dog Democrats, and the leadership is kind of out of touch with them. The leadership is far more liberal than they are. How do you think that, first of all, do you think that's an accurate representation of congressional reality, but then how does this play with public opinion?
I don't think that's necessarily an accurate assessment of the leadership or the incoming members. I mean, you've got a diverse group in both cases. And also the traditional divisions don't exist anymore. Let's take Iraq as an example. I mean, the caucus is fairly united they're fully united in changing course in Iraq. The details of one plan versus another are, there's nuanced differences, or there's substantive differences. But overall, the vision for charting a completely different course, one that has an exit strategy that that allows America to start bringing home our troops. Those things don't really break down along those traditional divisions. Similarly with ethics, which is going to be a big piece for restoring some credibility as agents of change and doing things differently than the previous Congress. You're not going to have, again, those things don't necessarily break down along party line, along different ideological camps within the party. If you look at the senators who were elected, I mean, you've got people from diverse states. You got a new senator from Rhode Island, a new senator from Missouri, a new senator from Montana and Virginia. So there's diversity there in terms of background. I don't see those divisions. I don't see the kind of divisions that you suggested. I see much more unity against the Bush ideology and the ideology of the outgoing Congress.
Yeah, my sense of reading things is that, in some sense, the public saw the Republicans as too extreme and too ideological, and were voting for something that was more centrist and more pragmatic. Is that a fair reading?
I think there is a lot to that. Yes, take a look at another event that happened a few years ago that I think did define. It's a long time ago; people don't remember it as much. But the Terri Schiavo case was a very good example of the Republican Congress, one, bending over backwards to satisfy a vocal piece of their constituency, of the party's right-wing base, but in a way that was completely out of touch with the priorities of the rest of the country. We had a situation where you've got Americans' cost of healthcare costs and education costs and transportation costs skyrocketing. I mean, real basic staples. And they see Congress not doing anything because of their ties with to the drug companies or their ties to the oil industry. Yet, so Congress isn't doing anything in this. But what do they see Congress doing? Flying back in the middle of the night for a vote in Congress to intervene in a family matter. That's the kind of thing that gets at what you're talking about. They saw the Congress that would completely just cater to themselves, not take care of what mattered to people, and serving people other than those who elected them.
I'm speaking with Jim Gerstein, Executive Director of the Democracy Corps.
Some commentators, liberals with enthusiasm and conservatives with alarm, see a streak of economic populism among some of the newly elected Democrats. You think that's true, and if so, what content is there to this populism?
I mentioned before the push for Medicare to negotiate drug prices, or for the government to negotiate drug prices for Medicare. That I think is the kind of thing that we'll see. Things that are taking on the big, that are taking on powerful corporate interests. That if you talk to voters, they feel powerless. They feel that they are being set aside for people who don't necessarily need the help. The populist streak that you're talking about is really something that's about taking on big companies that have had their way in Washington. It's tied into, and it plays off also the Dick Cheney, Halliburton getting special treatment, the idea that the gas, that the oil industry just gouged consumers all summer, and people have no control over the cost of gas, which really affects them. And the other thing is, if you look at the gains that Democrats made, I mean, there were gains in rural America. Well, rural America is very affected by drug prices. When you've got people driving 50, 60 miles to get to work each day and not necessarily driving high-mileage vehicles, these things really do affect people. And even when we saw gas prices dropping in the fall, it still was very high for people, and they still felt that the oil companies would just raise the prices after the election. So there is a very strong populist element out there, and there'll be important symbols and battles that give that meat.
Stephen Rose made a splash recently with a series of papers and articles arguing that a large portion of the electorate is actually fairly prosperous and fairly happy, economically speaking, and the message of economic anxiety doesn't play all that well. Do you think that's true, or is there an undercurrent of economic anxiety in the electorate?
I haven't read any of those articles, but I can tell you that when you speak with voters and you conduct national opinion surveys, it's very clear that there's a big disconnect between people hearing strong economic growth figures and the realities in their lives. We saw, and this came through very clear in all the focus group research we did, we saw people who just felt jobs were going overseas, it was hard to get a good job, that their incomes just could not keep up with the cost of key daily, you know, key items in people's lives, namely healthcare and education, and of course gas prices when that was peaking during the summer. So I think there's a lot of economic anxiety out there. I mean, people are optimistic. People want to have a positive view of their future, no doubt, but they are very, very concerned about their future, and they, at this point, don't really, the pressures are outweighing any optimism.
In one of your post-election write-ups, you said that, the Democrats won, people don't seem to feel too warmly towards the party, and I think the word you used was they don't revere the Democratic Party. What is the image of the Democrats now? I mean, the Republicans are certainly couldn't get much lower, but what's up with the popular perception of the Democratic Party?
If you look at both parties are at historic lows in the way they're viewed. The Republicans fell much further during this election than the Democrats, but you're right, they're still the Democrats have a lot to prove right now, and they will be measured over the next 2 years on what they do, and I'd say that they're kind of in the 50-50 range of positive and negative feelings, and obviously they couldn't have won this election if their numbers were as bad as the Republicans. But I would characterize it as the public is now listening to them and looking to them to prove themselves. The public has not shut out the Democrats, but they are not jumping up and down saying this is that their expectations are all going to be met. They need there's a moment for Democrats to prove themselves.
I think Bill Clinton said yesterday the voters gave the Democrats a chance but not a mandate.
Yeah, President Clinton, as usual, got it right. I mean, that's head on.
Let's talk about some of the specifics. You say that people are tired of the role of religion in politics. Could you talk a bit about that?
Well, I think they are tired of seeing. They were definitely tired of seeing Republicans put personal interest and the interests of certain groups in their party ahead of the public interest. You know, the Terry Schiavo case, which I mentioned earlier, is a prime example. People want to see government doing what they were elected to do, and this is right now they were elected to change course in Iraq. They were elected to bring a new way of doing business in Washington, putting public interests ahead of corporate interests, and like I said, they want change.
And then also, there's certainly some anti-gay marriage referenda passed, but your polling shows a greater tolerance of homosexuality in the American public. What's going on with that?
I think the more that the issue is debated over time, that the more it is a tolerant country, and the more that people are exposed to issues, the more we see we see numbers move on these kinds of issues.
So does that mean like the Republicans' kind of red meat social agenda is lost some of its power?
I think the effect of that red meat agenda is moving independent voters and young voters who also moved dramatically in this election towards Democrats. Those two groups, I mean, Democrats won young voters by 22 points in this election, whereas they only won them by 9 points in 2004. Independents went from basically even to a 20-point advantage in this election. That's the consequence of that kind of red meat agenda that you're referencing. There's consequences. A base strategy has moves the swing vote away from the Republicans.
So then, what kind of language should Democrats use? What kind of agenda should they use to maintain the affections of the people they've newly won in this election?
Well, I think a big piece of it is delivering on the promises that they made in this election, and And yeah, there's some are symbolic and some are really specific. You know, specific examples are raising the minimum wage and charting, you know, new course in Iraq. Very, very powerful issue that has really pervaded throughout all of our surveys over the last several years has been energy independence. People view this as a national security issue, and they very much want Democrats, or they very much want the country to work to get energy independence. They're very open to alternative energy sources. They're very open to sacrifice in order to achieve energy independence. So it's, you know, it's a national security issue. It's an economic issue, and that would be an opportunity for Democrats to own that issue the way Republicans have identified themselves with tax cuts or in smaller government, those kinds of identities. This is an opportunity for Democrats to really take on an issue and be identified with that kind of innovation.
And finally, President Bush's approval ratings are sliding again. They're back in the low 30s. What practical effect does a low approval rating have when it comes to running Washington?
Well, I mean, obviously this is connected to his performance as well as the post-election, as opposed to a bump, the post-election depression. But he, for the Republicans, but he, you know, his low approval ratings will make it harder for him to push back on the Democrats when they're proposing things. I mean, what does he do? Is he going to veto a minimum wage legislation? It makes it much harder to do when your approval ratings are in the low 30s than if they were in the high 60s. We saw when President Clinton was in office with a Republican Congress, he still had the ability to drive an agenda. It's fair to say that President Bush has very little ability to drive an agenda right now, and it's evident in Iraq, and it's evident, I guess, it's hard to see him taking up Social Security privatization again. It's hard to see him expanding tax cuts for the top 1% again, things like that. It's going to be very hard for him to pursue an agenda, and it gives the Democrats an opportunity to pursue their agenda and force him to make some tough choices.
Whatever that agenda might be, which is kind of vague. We've been listening to Jim Gerstein, who is the executive director of the Democracy Corps, a think tank that's closely associated with the Greenberg polling operation. And they were Bill Clinton's pollsters. They also do a lot of other political polling. And they were the people who did the research that helped British Petroleum recast itself as Beyond Petroleum, BP, the environmentally crunchy company. But lots of interesting information in their polling focus groups and stuff. If you want to find out what's going on with public opinion and why people vote the way they do, there's a lot of good information from the Democracy Corps. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'm going to get off a little early to make way for the candidates. There's some sort of election going on, I think. So we need to make way for that. So let's listen to this little excerpt from... live at a club in Hungary, recorded a couple of years ago, Satoshi Tomy and Lexicon Avenue, for our little weekend dance music send-off. Till next week. Bye.
I heard about this one party. Just sweat on the wall.